The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Okay, good evening, everyone. It's good to be with you. Special welcome to people who are new to Village Zendo, and I hope you will stick around afterwards for our newcomers meeting if you'd like to chat a little bit. My name is Shinryu, and the great Japanese filmmaker Akira Kurosawa said that the role of the artist is to not look away. And when he was a boy, 13 years old, there was a big earthquake where he lived, and his older brother took him out into the city to see the destruction. And it was kind of an awful scene. And when the boy wanted to look away from what was in front of him, his elder brother wouldn't let him. His elder brother forced him to really look and see what it was. And so, this principle of not looking away is something that seems to have really shaped the filmmaking that Kurosawa did. And he was able to transform his vision of human suffering into great art. So not looking away, there's another way that not looking away comes up in terms of the history of the mid-20th century and World War II and the Holocaust. Many people have said that the Holocaust was so horrible that it's really indescribable. It's not possible to represent it, and it's not possible to comprehend it. And that any attempt to try to explain it essentially rationalizes what happened. But some historians have tried to push back against that idea. And there's a historian who I like a lot, and Australian historian named Inga Clendinnen, who her own work was on pre-conquest and early post-conquest indigenous society in Mexico. But towards the latter part of her career, she wrote a book on the Holocaust. And one of the things that she tried to do in there was to get away from this idea that the Holocaust is too horrible to really look at. She called it the Gorgon effect. Maybe you remember from mythology, the Gorgon is this half-human, half-beastly creature who is so terrifying that if anyone who looks at a Gorgon will turn to stone. And so Clendinnen was trying to say, actually, we have to look at the Gorgon. She said, you know, even though the experience of the Holocaust is something that tends to produce, I think she said, a sickening of the imagination or in a weakening of the will to grapple with what happened, we really have a need and responsibility to try to look at it. So we might say that for Clendinnen too, the role of the historian is also to not look away. And one other example from the Second World War and the Holocaust, the German writer Walter Benjamin came up with the image of what he called the Angel of History. And the Angel of History was looking at the past and seeing history move towards it. And that past was a huge storm. And the gale force winds of that storm would catch in the wings of the angel and push it backwards into the future. And the angel was there looking at history and seeing all of the wreckage piling up from history. So the angel of history was also not looking away. And I think that our practice, in a way, is about this. We could say maybe that our practice is has to follow a precept of not looking away. We normally have a fusatsu once a month, an atonement ceremony, and we talk about a precept. And this month, because we're starting our retreat, we don't have a fusatsu ceremony, but in a way, I think there's something of a precepts talk here, the precept of not looking away. I think that all of us at one point or another don't really feel like sitting down on our cushion and looking at the calamity or the horror or the wreckage of our minds and of our life. But that is what we have to do sometimes. It's not always like that. It's not always so dramatic. Sometimes it's pretty ordinary or maybe pleasant, but there are times when it feels like that. And so our practice has to allow for that. So we sit and we try to see what there is in front of us. Nan Xuan, in a famous koan, said, "People see this peony as if in a dream." And I think we all tend to look at our life and our world as if in a dream, in a certain sense, and that we're so caught up in our thoughts and in our desires about how things should be, how we want them to be. But our practice is to see clearly. And so we can think of our practice and our zazen, starting with the foundation of our practice, our sitting, as really not looking away or bearing witness. So there's a kind of a quality, I think, of kshanti that goes with this. Kshanti is a Sanskrit term which means forbearance. It's one of the paramitas or the qualities that a bodhisattva, an enlightening being, has. And forbearance means patience, it means restraint, it means tolerance, rather than an impulsive reaction. And I think that is something that is important in our sitting practice. And so that forbearance, patience is not a weakness. It can be a strength for us in the face of adversity and our trials and tribulations. So bearing witness to the joys, but also the suffering in our life, to the beauties and also the misery in our life and in our world. And we have the reference of the spirit of compassion. The bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara's name, comes from looking on the world and looking on the suffering of the world. And so it's this quality in our zazen and our practice can be also, I think, a form of compassion towards ourselves and towards our society as a whole. And I don't think that it's a it's an impassive quality either, or in a sense of imperviousness or unfeeling. I remember a story about a Japanese man who became a teacher, not a Zen teacher, but I think he developed a kind of body work that had a lot of Zen influence. And he told the story of how, as a young boy, he was walking with his father one day. It was very hot and humid out. And he said to his father, he complained about how hot and humid it was. And his father said, "Complaining about the weather is not going to change it." And I remember when I heard that story, I thought, that sounds like a very stern, paternal things to say. But in retrospect, I don't know. It could have been said in a joking way. It could have been harsh, or maybe it was compassionate. But I think that our zazen and our practice needs to have the ability to incorporate those feelings, to acknowledge those feelings. Maybe the desire to kvetch, or the feelings of fear or righteous fury or sorrow. But it is not without feeling. I think maybe we also have to look at the other side. Is there a liability to not looking away? And I think it's true that sometimes we do have to pull back if we're really overwhelmed in a situation, or if we're too obsessed in a situation. You know, our lives have been pretty overwhelming. There's been so much wreckage this year with the pandemic, with the economic crisis, with, and not just this year, but the past 4 years of political strife, the decades of strife, the wreckage with the dismantling of civil rights or immigration rights or labor rights, the dismantling of a welfare state worked out with all of its problems through a kind of pact between labor and capital and an international order worked out through some, with all its problems, through various kinds of pacts as well, but a lot of which is eroding and leaving wreckage. So it's been a very hard time, and it's been overwhelming at points, I'm sure, for many of us. So being able to pull back is important at times. And also to, if we're too caught up in things, if we're too fixated on things, we may need to pull back, to turn off the TV, to put down the cell phone, cut off the news cycle, take a breath, reconnect with where we are right now, that too can become too much a source of anxiety. But even in these cases, I think our practice can be large enough to incorporate those feelings of feeling that we're at our limits, or that we've gone over the limit. and we can allow that, and we can see that those feelings, we can hear the alarm bells within our own system. Take refuge in the midst of all of the the turmoil. I think that this bearing witness is also not simply a passive stance, a stance of disengagement or just voyeurism. It can allow us the possibility to see a little more clearly. It can allow us a kind of space and openness of heart and mind to see what's going on in front of us and to find a way to respond, either because we know what needs to be done, or we intuit what needs to be done, or even if we don't know. It can allow us to make our best effort rather than react in an impulsive way or to in a way that's just trapped within our ideas and ideologies. So we may see that the peony in the garden needs watering or needs weeding. We may see that our body needs tending to, or we need to tend to our household or our workplace or our community. We need to tend to our friends and family and colleagues and comrades and sangha mates. So I'd just like to take a moment and thank our Shuso and all of the people who are working behind the scenes to put together our year-end retreat as an example of getting off the cushion and responding and doing what's needed. There is an old Chinese Mahayana Buddhist text that we normally chant when we're on retreat, which is this song of the jewel mirror of samadhi. And there's a line in the text which says, "Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a mass of fire." Turning away here may be a little bit different from what I'm talking about, but I think it's also connected. I think that the teaching here is that if we are turning away from it, we will grow cold, we'll grow chilled, we'll eventually freeze. But if we try to touch it, we'll burn our hands. And so our practice is not denying, but not indulging, not rejecting, but not attaching. Our practice of Zazen and our practice as a whole can be a middle way in the face of the mass of fire. So we're coming up on our year-end retreat, and I think it's a really valuable time for us. We have been through so much this year. There's probably a toll that's been taken that we're not fully aware of. And this is something that I always find on retreat, that it's not until I start sitting that I realize how agitated I am in my mind. And it takes a while to really be able to settle down. But that's really important work that we can do on retreat. And there's a lot to let settle at the end of this year. So there's been an interesting conversation online about the difference between an online retreat and our regular residential retreat. And I think there's no question that there's a huge difference between the two. They feel very different. But being able to sit together and practice together day in and day out for nearly a week really will make a difference. It was clear to me from doing our online retreat this summer that the effects, although they may be more subtle, are very real. The practice does penetrate our life and change us. That was something I wasn't sure about before we did our summer retreat, but I'm now convinced about. So I think this is a really important opportunity for us. It's a time when we can really see the wreckage in our life and in our world after this difficult year. And we can also prepare the ground for responding appropriately in the time that's coming. So I hope to see you there. Wish you well, finishing up the year and beginning the new one. Thank you.